God, thou hast allowed me to live till now. I thank thee and offer up my sufferings to thee and pray thee at the same time to take me further into thy protection. This and several other pious meditations I had with God, and I considered my destiny. Although it was never quiet the entire night, and though a new battle might have started at any hour, none of all my miseries was so hard and depressing as the thought of my brothers, sisters, and friends. This thought was my greatest pain, which I sought to repress with this hope. With God, everything is possible, so I will depend upon His further help. In the month of January 1812, I was recalled to the garrison of Schondorf. From here, the entire corps marched through the Würzburg district, where it was generally rumoured that we were going to Spain and would embark onto the Baltic Sea. Although the outlook did not seem good, I and all the other soldiers were very merry, always singing and dancing, especially since throughout the entire Würzburg country, the quarters and eating and drinking were very good, particularly because of the large supply of wine. So that everyone voluntarily had his flask filled with wine and his pockets with cookies at the time of departure. Moreover, the beautiful villages on the main river, surrounded by vineyards, fruit trees and grain fields, put everyone in a happy mood. We were still very lively in these towns, singing and laughing cheerfully, although we could imagine the unusual campaign before us. But everyone always believes in and hopes for the best. From there, the line of the march turned towards Frankfurt on the Oder, where a halt was made. Here we were quartered for 3 days, and by this time we had to be contented with poor food and regiment bread. We had to drill even on Ascension Day, so General Hugel tried to remind His Royal Highness the Crown Prince not to drill, saying that it was a holiday. The Crown Prince, however, gave this answer. "I will do you a favour, General, and not arrest you. Do you think I don't know what day it is?" On Corpus Christi Day, we marched into the city of Thorn. Here, for the first time, we saw all the corps streaming together. All the gates were jammed and the regiments had to wind through the streets in a great throng. We still obtained quarters. However, we had to prepare our own food from our rationed meat and bread. The meat came from the salted ice pits. There was a rumour that it had been stored from the War of 1807. The condition of the meat made the rumour seem credible, since the meat appeared bluish black and was sharp as herrings. Daily, the hardships increased, and there was no hope of bread. My colonel spoke to us once and said that we could hope for no more bread until we crossed the enemy border. On June 25th, the army went over the bridges. We now believed that, once in Russia, we need do nothing but forage, which, however, proved to be an illusion. The towns were already stripped before we could enter, and so were all the villages. Here and there a hog ran around and was beaten with clubs, chopped with sabres and stabbed with bayonets. Several times I succeeded in cutting off something, but I had to chew it and eat it uncooked, since my hunger could not wait for a chance to boil the meat. During the third night, a halt was made in a field which was trampled into a swamp. Here we were ordered to camp and to make fires, since neither village nor forest could be seen, and the rain continued without end. Well, you can imagine in what a half-numbed condition everyone stood here. What could we do? There was nothing that we could do but stack the rifles in pyramids and keep moving in order not to freeze. Meanwhile, a cellar full of brandy had been discovered. I too pushed myself into the cellar and filled my field flask. I returned to the shelter with this and drank it without even any bread. Then, by noon, I noticed that half the men had stayed back and several had suffocated in the swamp. The brandy helped, but many a man drank himself to death because he would become numbed and would freeze on account of the wet and cold. It then happened to be good weather, but in order to obtain water for drinking and cooking, holes were dug into the swamps 3 feet deep, in which the water collected. The water was very warm, however, and was reddish-brown with millions of little red worms, so that it had to be bound in linen and sucked through with the mouth. This was, of course, a hardship for any man, and particularly for us, living as we were. The march was kept up day and night. One man after another stretched himself half dead upon the ground. Most of them died a few hours later. Several, however, suddenly fell to the ground, dead. The chief cause of this was thirst, for in most districts there was no water fit for drinking, so the men had to drink out of the ditches in which were dead horses and dead men. On August 16, we came towards the city of Smolensk. Here, my company had only 25 fit men. On the morning of August 17th, every regiment was set in motion and all advanced in columns against the Russians. Here, every regiment, without exception, was under fire. Again and again, the troops attempted assaults, but because of the greater number of Russians, we were forced back every time on this day, since their heavy artillery stood on the heights and could hit everything. Finally, by night, we had made good our position on the heights overlooking the city, and the battle was discontinued. That night, the thought of the coming day alternated with fitful sleep, and in fantasy, the many dead men and horses came as a world of spirits before the last judgment. As soon as the day broke, we marched against the city. The river was crossed below the city. The suburbs on the northern side were stormed, set on fire, and burnt up. My company's doctor, named Staubel, had his arm shot away in crossing the stream, and he died afterwards. No longer could I pay any attention to my comrades, and therefore knew not in what way they perished or were lost. Everyone fired and struck at the enemy in wild madness, and no one could tell whether he was in front, in the middle, or behind the center of the army. On August the 19th, the entire army moved forward and pursued the Russians with all speed. From Smolensk to Moshevsk, the war displayed its horrible work of destruction. All the roads, fields, and woods lay as though sown with people, horses, wagons, burned villages and cities. Everything looked like the complete ruin of all that lived. In particular, we saw 10 dead Russians to one of our men, although every day our numbers fell off considerably. The cities in the meantime were Dorogobuzh, Semlevo, Vyazma, and Gushetsk. The march up to there, as far as it was a march, is indescribable and inconceivable for people who have not seen anything of it. The very great heat, the dust, which was like a thick fog, the closed line of marching columns, and the putrid water from holes filled with dead people and cattle brought everyone close to death, and eye pains, fatigue, thirst, and hunger tormented everybody. God, how I remembered the bread and beer which I had enjoyed at home with such indifferent pleasure. How gladly would I renounce my whole life the warm food so common at home, if I only did not lack good bread and beer now. Wherever I looked, I saw the soldiers with dead, half-desperate faces. Many cried out in despair, "If only my mother had not borne me." Some demoralized men even cursed their parents and their birth. On the route to Moscow on September the 7th, every corpse was assigned its place and the signal to attack was given. Like thunderbolts, the firing began both against and from the enemy. This beautiful grain region without woods and villages could now be compared to a cleared forest, a few trunks here and there looking grey and white. Within a space an hour and a half long and wide, the ground was covered with people and animals. We moved forward and camped by a forest on a height facing Moscow. It was full of green trees. Now we travelled with somewhat higher hopes towards Moscow, yet with the expectation that we should clash again with the Russians, but the Russians thought themselves too weak and went through the city, setting fire to many parts, and the inhabitants were abandoned. On the march into the city, or rather on the march towards it, from a hill in a forest an hour and a half away, we saw the huge city lying before us. Clouds of fire, red smoke, great gilded crosses of the church towers glittered, shimmered, and billowed up towards us from the city. This holy city was like the description of the city of Jerusalem, over which our Saviour wept. It even resembled the horror and the wasting according to the gospel. After a few hours walking, we went past the Palace Kremlin. In Moscow, one could find and buy provisions, for each soldier was now citizen, merchant, innkeeper, and baker of Moscow. Whoever could find nothing could buy something, and vegetables in sufficient quantity stood in the fields. It was still good weather, and one could sleep warm enough under a coat at night. After we had been citizens of Moscow for 4 weeks, we lost our burgher rights again. Napoleon refused the peace treaty proposed to him, and the army, which had advanced some 30 hours further on, had to retreat, because the Russian army stationed in Moldavia was approaching. Now it was October the 17th, and Napoleon held an army review and announced the departure for October 18th, early in the morning at 3 o'clock, with the warning that whoever should delay 1 hour would fall into the hands of the enemies. All beer, brandy, etc. was abandoned, and whatever was still intact was ordered to be burnt. Napoleon himself had the Kremlin undermined and blown up. Then everyone packed up, and the enemy attacked us. The decision was soon to the advantage of the Russians, and all ran in a crowded retreat, the army moving towards Kaluga, with the Cossacks in front and behind us. Those who were too weak to carry their weapons or knapsacks threw them away, and all looked like a crowd of gypsies. The fighting, the shrieking, the firing of large and small guns, hunger and thirst, and all conceivable torments increased the never-ending confusion. Indeed, even the lice seemed to seek supremacy, for their number on both officers and privates was in the thousands. In these days, it snowed for the first time, and the snow remained. The cold arrived at the same time too, and the freezing of the people multiplied the number of the dead. No one could walk 50 paces without seeing men stretched out half or completely dead. We arrived at Smolensk on November the 12th, having made from Moscow to that city 26 days and nights of travel without pausing a day. Here we settled down and had to camp for 2 days. Every night the fires for warming could be seen over a region 4 hours long and wide, reddening the sky like red cloth. Again and again people died, and sometimes froze to death. These were people who pressed towards the fire, but were seldom permitted to get there, so they died away from the fire, and very often they were even converted into cushions in order that the living would not have to sit on the snow. When we came near the Beresina River, there was a place where Napoleon ordered the pack horses to be unharnessed and where he ate. He watched his army pass by in the most wretched condition. What he may have felt in his heart is impossible to surmise. His outward appearance seemed indifferent and unconcerned over the wretchedness of his soldiers. Only ambition and lost honour may have made themselves felt in his heart. In this region we came to a half-burnt village away from the road, in which a cellar was found under a mansion. We sought for potatoes, and I also pressed down the broad stairway, although the cellar was already half filled with people. When I was at the bottom of the steps, the screaming began under my feet. Everyone crowded in and no one could get out. Here people were trampled to death and suffocated. Those who wanted to stoop down for something were bowled over by those standing and had to be stepped upon. In spite of the murderous shrieking and frightful groaning, the pressure from outside increased. The poor, deathly weak men who fell had to lie there until dead under the feet of their own comrades. I thought of my friends at home and compared my misery and approaching end with my former life of plenty. I remembered a common saying at home, a campaign is always made out to be worse than it was. With this common notion, I consoled myself, thinking, it's well that you, my beloved kindred and friends, know nothing of my condition, for it would only cause you pain, and it would be of no use to me. I gave up pushing into the cellar, and I thought in cold fear, how will I get out again? I pressed flat against the wall so that it afforded me shelter and pushed myself vigorously, little by little, up the stairs. This was almost impossible, with others treading on my long coat. Finally, I came to Ortelsburg and for the first time was given regular quarters. From this city, I went on to Morava and at that place received quarters again. It was just Christmas Eve, a date I would not have known if I had not learnt it from the landlord. The washing of my hands and face proceeded very slowly, because the crusts on my hands, ears and nose had grown like furlark, with cracks and coal-black scales. I washed, then, for an hour, with hot water and soap. However, I felt I had only become somewhat smoother and lighter, but I could not notice any removal of the blackness and the scales. Finally, on February the 24th, 1813, I arrived at Elvangen. My convoyter here had left behind 100 dead out of 175 men. All at once I saw my brother-in-law and my brother. They would not have recognized me, of course, as I looked then, but I called, thrust out my hand, and greeted them. They jumped into the air for joy and pressed my hands, and our hearts alone could feel, for we could not speak. Oh, that all people might know how high the love of friends and relatives can mount through such a meeting. One feels in it heavenly joy, the all-wise providence of God, and at the same time, the miracle of nature.